Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Reparations means payback. In the case of slavery and its aftermath in America, it means payback for irreparable damage, which is to say it may be practically impossible and morally required. Our history of paying down the debt for slavery is one of promises broken, like the famous offer of 40 acres and a mule made to slaves who would be liberated by war. It was also the short-lived reconstruction of the South with full citizenship, equality, and freedom for black citizens. All of it undone after seven mystic years, in W.E.B. Du Bois's phrase. We have a history also of what looked like good intentions, New Deal benefits in the 1930s, the federal housing loans that built suburbia after World War II, but were all designed not to include black families. Reparations is a cause that sleeps but never dies, and it's back full force in a comprehensive book from the University of North Carolina called From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century. We are honored to welcome the co-authors this hour, William A. Darity, Jr., historian, trained as an economist, and Kirsten Mullen, co-writer and lecturer on race, art, history, and politics. I find a lot of dollars and cents detail that I'd never known before your book, and a strong progressive logic. But the real news may be in the public atmosphere, broad and deep introspection about race in this American spring and summer. The timing feels right. Are we ready for your arguments? Maybe even for real reparations?
This is a pregnant moment. But of course, the moment that these things should have taken place was right after the end of the period of enslavement, when the newly emancipated slaves had been promised 40-acre plots of land by the federal government. This would have given them the kind of resources that they needed to begin to build their wealth, but also, you know, the opportunity to have a capital stake, you know, to have something of their own compensation for all of these years of unpaid labor. That is when this should have happened. And there have been a number of points since then. The New Deal, for example, the GI Bill, affirmative action, Homestead Act.
Right.
These are moments when, you know, Black Americans could have been included. But this whole question of citizenship has always been one that's never been settled. Black Americans are citizens of this country, but have never enjoyed the full status of citizenship.
Sandy Darity, you're an economist, MIT trained, and the money in this story is a touchstone for you. Median household wealth is sort of the test, and it's a 10-to-1 imbalance now between black and white, and it's been that way for a long time. You say the job won't be done until that ratio is equal, black and white. Explain what you're driving at, and this emphasis on money.
So in the present moment, Black Americans constitute about 13% of the nation's population, but only possess about 2.6% of the nation's wealth. And we think this is an index of the cumulative intergenerational effects of a variety of atrocities that have been inflicted on the Black community that have adversely affected their position in terms of economic security and well-being. What we argue is that the target of a reparations program must be elimination of the racial wealth differential in its entirety. We focus on the mean difference between Black and white wealth. So at the household level, that would amount to a difference of $800,000 between the average Black and the average white household. It would also require at least a target goal of the United States government intervening with the provision of upwards of $10 to $12 trillion on behalf of the Black community in the United States to eliminate that differential.
How much money are we talking about, dare I ask?
the minimum would be $10 to $12 trillion. If we're concerned about additional compensation for the full array of atrocities, including mental damage, the murders of so many Black Americans and the like that go beyond property losses, then we're probably talking about a figure somewhere in the vicinity of $14 to $15 trillion.
Explain who gets it. Is it a voucher for college education? Is it a piece of land, or is it cash?
So we're talking about Black American descendants who can confirm that they are descended from at least one person who was enslaved in the U.S. And they also would need to have identified at least 12 years before the enactment of a reparations program or the creation of a study to examine the question of reparations, whichever came first. They would need to have self-identified as Black, African-American, or Negro.
Why is that self-ID important?
There's a possibility of folks recognizing that this might be a moment when they could benefit, you know, from becoming Black. And so this is to, you know, reduce the likelihood that that kind of thing would happen. You know, there's a real cost to being a Black person in this country. And if one has not actually lived that, one shouldn't be deserving of reparations.
But what about people who want to say, I have multiple origins in my DNA, and I want to present as X, Y, or Z, or Tiger Woods, but I don't want to be exclusively Black, or maybe nothing in terms of racial identity.
So we established that the criterion is one that is based upon self-classification. So it suggests that the individual, to some degree, has embedded themselves within the experience of being Black in the United States. So folks who have distanced themselves from that would not be eligible for reparations under our program.
How does the money get paid out? And would it be paid out in programs comparable, say, to the Homestead Act, a land grant that gets a farmer started and over the years has become immensely valuable?
So yes, so this is a portfolio that we're talking about. Potentially, what would a program of reparations look like on the ground? So yes, it certainly could contain, for example, funds to create endowments for historically Black colleges and universities. It might include establishing hospitals or clinics in communities where there was none. It might include college scholarships. But we think, in addition to those kinds of programs that larger numbers of folks, you know, communities could participate in, that there also should be direct payments of cash to these Black American descendants of U.S. slavery. You know, both for symbolic and substantive reasons. For us, you know, one of the major goals of a reparations program is eliminating the Black-white wealth gap. And all of these other programs, even taken together, will not do that. You need direct payments to begin to eradicate that $800,000 gap per household.
So the indirect approaches have their merits. But if the objective is to erase the wealth differential, for the most part, they won't do that. Let me provide one illustration, which is the inevitable focus that people always place on education, which seems to be the cure-all for all of our economic problems. It's not. And I say that as an individual who is passionately committed to the educational enterprise. But one of the most disturbing pieces of evidence that's emerged from the work that my research team has done on wealth and race in the United States is the fact that a Black head of household with a college degree has two-thirds of the net worth of a white head of household who's never finished high school. So the educational enterprise is not going to have the effect of eliminating the racial wealth gap. You've got to do it directly. Kirsten mentioned cash payments. You could also use other types of payments. You could set up endowments or you could have trust accounts for eligible recipients. But there needs to be some form of a direct payment that's made to Black American descendants of U.S. slavery.
You mentioned Homestead. This is referring to a set of initiatives that began in 1862. So this is before the Civil War had ended, when plots of 160 acres each were available to Americans supposedly who had not raised arms against the country, against the Union, could settle the lands out west. This is a way of both extending the reach and the the imperialism, really, of the U.S. government.
Settler colonialism,
basically. Yeah. Some 287 million acres of land was parsed out, and nominal fees were paid. But Black people, first of all, they weren't eligible to be property owners before emancipation. But that program lasted 76 years. Very, very, very few Black people benefited from that program. And you're mentioning it now, which lands you're thinking of would be available?
That's a good question.
To parcel out to Black Americans, because part of the reason to end the program was a decision to have the remaining lands become basically national parks.
The 2020 context of all of this fascinates me, starting with the COVID season. I mean, we're learning to think in trillions, not exactly, but if you've got a pandemic disease and you've got to save the country and the economy, a trillion here, a trillion there, just spend it. Save the people is the spirit. Some of that rubs off on race solutions too. I mean, if we're investing in a different sort of future, think enormously big. We're talking about growth. We're talking about justice. Why not? Is that a piece of the thinking?
I think absolutely. You know, the coronavirus only further dramatizes the case for reparations. You know, we have seen excess Black mortality, the collapse of Black businesses and employment. It's always an urgent time to adopt reparations. It's been urgent for 155 years since the end of American slavery. This is a great time for the nation to pay this debt. And you know, you're talking about racial justice. It's time right. for that as well. So, yes, I think this moment has shown us that we can pay for a reparations program. The question is, do we have the will to do so?
In the Democratic primaries and debates, it was Marianne Williamson who embraced reparations completely. I thought it was surprising and tremendously interesting. But then it played out, it seemed to me, implicitly in South Carolina's primary between Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden. Bernie Sanders is a sort of old-fashioned Euro-socialist, to each according to his need. And it's not about your history, it's about your need today. Joe Biden, maybe implicitly, with strong support from Jim Clyburn in South Carolina, and with strong Black support, was talking about something else, including the value of apology, of making up specifically to Black sensibilities as well as Black finances. Am I right there in that distinction?
You can't really talk solely about Black Americans in the present because this intergenerational weight is something that every Black American carries. Black Americans carry, first of all, the inability to have accumulated wealth over generations. There is a cost in one's body when one does not have what one needs to survive and thrive.
Coming up, so many urgent arguments for reparations from Frederick Douglass in the 1870s up to Ta-Nehisi Coates in 2014. Why no delivery? This is Open Source. William, known as Sandy Darity, and Kirsten Mullen have written together a modern compendium on reparations for the sin and outright theft of slave labor that built the foundations of not just the Cotton South, but America's global industrial empire. You point out a lot of roads not taken, starting with the Declaration of Independence, in which Jefferson said, all men are created equal, and might have said, Black men too, but he didn't. To me, the most compelling idea that wasn't implemented was compensation emancipation, by which the U.S. government would have bought the freedom of the slaves and compensated their old owners for the labor they were losing. Abraham Lincoln pushed the idea hard, free the slaves and save the Union. And as you write, the nation did not have to go to war with itself to bring slavery to an end. How close did the planters come to accepting that deal? And why didn't they?
If we think about compensated emancipation as an option that could have been exercised, it would have meant that you would not have had the massive loss of life that took place during the course of the Civil War. It may have meant that you could have had liberation of the slaves and simultaneously the prospect of actually introducing some form of restitution for the slaves themselves mm-hmm. after having paid their former slave holders for their freedom. So we could have had a very, very different world, a world without the Civil War, if compensated emancipation had been pursued. I think that there was some degree of inclination to adopt a compensated emancipation project on the part of a significant segment of the Republican Party under Lincoln's leadership, but there was absolute resistance on the part of Southern slaveholders. So it didn't happen.
Well, there was the one instance when the District of Columbia.
Yeah, that's the only case.
It was the only case where, you know, slave owners were compensated for their human chattel. Lincoln tried really hard to convince Delaware to do so. Delaware had a relatively small number of enslaved Black people, but they were one vote short. You know, I think part of it too is from what we've been able to learn about the Civil War, I think the South really expected to win. And they expected to be able to continue practicing slavery. I don't think they calculated on losing the war.
You know, frequently we hear from people that the debt has been paid because of the more than 600,000 lives that were lost in the course of the Civil War.
Yeah, we now say 750,000 lives.
Yeah. It's interesting because, you know, close to half of those were lives that were lost by people who were trying to preserve slavery. We have to deduct them from the total. So when we get in the vicinity of 350,000 Union soldiers who lost their lives, we also have to keep in mind a significant portion of those were actually Black soldiers who were fighting for their own liberation. So this was not just a matter of Black Americans being handed the gift of emancipation. Black Americans were actively involved in the process of self-emancipation. There was the ultimate sacrifice that was being given by Black soldiers as well. But I think the key point is that the war did not actually have to occur.
Move into the 20th century and speak of missed opportunities in almost memory. The New Deal, for example, but then the GI Bill, those FHA mortgages, undone for Black people by redlining, and other comparable tragedies. What are the big ones, and why did they happen?
Well, I think, you know, a big part of the trade-off, the conversations around the New Deal on the part of the Southern legislators was, well, you know, we will accept this program, but we absolutely don't want to be part of any kind of initiative that's going to bring the Black people who, you know, are in our districts into parity with whites. The backroom conversation was such that they excluded domestic workers, excluded farmers from these appropriations, right? So, you know, these are occupations that largely were filled by Black people. So whites were able to benefit. They could, you know, see themselves as cooperative. But wink, wink, we all know that Black Americans are not going to be part of this. And one has to also lay that burden of guilt at the feet of the Northern legislators who agreed to the deal.
Come to post-war and the GI Bill, which educated veterans for a booming economy. How did Black people get shuffled out of that one?
These were federal programs, but they were administered locally. So you have to go into, you know, your local officer who knows your family, may have enslaved your family, who's not really interested in seeing you and your family get ahead by helping you obtain, you know, an education or training that many of the whites in the district did not have access to. You know, either your paperwork is not completely satisfactory or your paperwork gets misplaced.
But the other dimension of this also is that the GI Bill was an important mechanism for returning veterans to purchase homes.
Right.
There was a home mortgage support dimension to the GI Bill. And I think in Ira Katz Nelson's book, When Affirmative Action Was White, he actually points out that in the extreme in the state of Mississippi, there were only two returning Black veterans who received any funds from the GI Bill to support home purchases.
Bring it into the 60s. Malcolm X was strong, not just for reparations. He wanted a separate republic for Black people and great swaths of the country. James Forman Sr. of Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee is remembered for opening a conference in New York with a Black manifesto at Riverside Church, 1969. He wanted $500 million mostly from white churches and synagogues. The white democratic socialist Michael Harrington said the money wasn't half enough, forget about it. And the revered Black organizer Bayard Rustin said, it is insulting to Negroes to offer them reparations for past generations of suffering, as if the balance of an irreparable past could be set straight with a handout. Get from there to here in the thinking, writing, popular feeling about reparations, including the great Ta-Nehisi Coates and his case for reparations in the Atlantic Monthly, I think 2014.
Well, I'd like to insert that Frederick Douglass also said that the magnitude of these harms are so immense that you truly cannot pay for them in full. But he said, you should pay as much as you can.
He never fails.
So I disagree with Bayard Rustin, and I suspect Frederick Douglass would have disagreed with him as well.
But stick with the puzzle about the value of an apology, and Bayard Rustin is alluding to that. There's something about his dignity that is not for sale, and his sense of a wrong that must be paid for other ways too.
It's not Black people's dignity that's for sale. You know, what we're talking about is righting a wrong, paying a debt, and eliminating the wealth gap. This is not personal. It's about taking responsibility for an obligation that the country owes.
So an interview I did with Slate a few days ago, where the journalist described me as saying that reparations would constitute gifts that should be paid to Black Americans. I never use the term gifts. Hmm. A debt that is met is not a gift. So I think Bayard Rustin's just simply wrong. I would say this, if we think about other cases where people have been subjected to severe victimization, it's quite normal to provide them with monetary compensation, even though there's a recognition that that doesn't fully meet the magnitude of the harm. So, you know, this ranges from the payments that the federal government made to Japanese Americans who were unjustly incarcerated during World War II.
Yep.
It includes the payments that were made to victims of the Holocaust in Germany.
Now speak about the viable precedents, model instances. Ida B. Wells liked to refer to I take it as fact that Russian serfs were given 3 acres of land when they were freed, roughly the time of our Civil War. How many other instances are there of reparations like that?
If you think about the case of Japanese Americans who were wrongfully interned in the U.S. in World War II, it took about 40 years, you know, for that reckoning to happen. But the decision was made to give reparations to the approximately 117,000 individuals who had been interned. You know, this was based on a calculation of the length of time that they were interned. Internments, you know, lasted maybe from 2 to 4.5 years, probably for the longest. Now, they did not compensate for the loss of property, didn't compensate for, you know, psychological trauma. They did not compensate for the kind of investments that people could have made had their businesses, their farms, et cetera, been intact. But there was this acknowledgement that a wrong had been committed and that something was owed. When you think about the case of 9/11, this is a very interesting one. At 9/11, you had around 5,000 claims. The majority of them were for individuals who had died on 9/11. And you had in the person of Kenneth Feinberg, who was the special master, the decision was left to him to decide who would receive compensation and how much. He made the decision that he would base compensation not, as in the case with Japanese Americans, a fixed payment for everyone. Feinberg instead decided that he would tag the compensation to the current income of the victim. So let's say you were in graduate school, you were working on an MBA, but on 9/11, your actual job was that of a courier for Federal Express on the second floor of the World Trade Center. So your compensation is based not on your potential, not on what you might become, not on your hopes and dreams, but on the $9 an hour that you made as a courier. Feinberg's, I had an opportunity to talk with him when he came to Duke University last year. And he said, actually has written, that he thought that was a mistake. if he were given a do-over, he would make all of the payments the same. And we would concur. You know, we think that, you know, they should be equal. And that
we would err in the direction of more equal payments across all recipients rather than differentiated payments.
Yes. I assumed, wrongly it turns out, that Feinberg would be a proponent of reparations for Black Americans. I was just a fangirl. I was so excited to be meeting him. But boy, did he prove me wrong. He said, absolutely, you know, this is a horrible idea. And the grounds that he gave were first that it would be impossible to determine who the recipients of reparations should be. And then he argued that slavery created this situation where white laborers had to were put at a disadvantage because they were competing against these free laborers and they were put at a disadvantage. And I thought, wow. But, you know, basically he was not really thinking, first of all, about how many whites were connected to slavery. The numbers of white families that owned, you know, Black bodies is extremely high.
In the South.
In the South, especially.
In states like South Carolina and Mississippi, it was in excess of 55% of individuals who lived in families where Black people were owned as slaves. And in throughout all of the states of the Confederacy, I think the lowest percentage was about 25%. There were so many white workers who were participants in the system, not only as being members of families that owned enslaved Black people, but because of the types of jobs that they themselves held, including various kinds of jobs that were involved with managing, policing, and controlling Black bodies, or individuals who were engaged in trade with the slaveholding plantations. This was the core enterprise in the southern states, and very, very few people who were white were not involved in that enterprise. And so that's why when the South goes to war, it's not a case of large numbers of poor white Southerners being dragged into the war. It is a situation where white Southerners collectively had a significant self-interest in preserving slavery.
I wanted to mention one other reparations program that we have looked at, and this is Sandy Hook. This was the horrible mass murder of children and several educators in Sandy Hook, Connecticut. Feinberg actually was brought in as an arbiter. In that case, what was happening on the ground was a battle between the families of the 26 who had lost their lives and groups like the United Way and others who were receiving funds on behalf of these families. And so the question was, how should these funds be used? And so there was a lot of talk about community centers and setting up therapy sessions. And the families were incensed. And Feinberg, you know, came in and met with them and ultimately sided with the families and said, you know, the money needs to go directly to the families, not to the community. And the families can decide, as many of them did, in fact, you know, how they wanted to spend the money. And many of them did choose to create, you know, foundations or centers or initiatives in their children's names. But it was their choice.
But that sounds sort of like your logic, does it not?
It is our logic. Right. Yeah. But when Feinberg was questioned, he was like, well, no, you know, this is an exception somehow. And so our question is, why is it, you know, the rules apply to everyone else, but somehow when we're talking about, you know, Black Americans, we need some other kind of intervention.
We're talking about the history of even the talk about reparations. I want your take on what Ta-Nehisi Coates did to the conversation with his extraordinary magazine article in 2014 on, fascinatingly, Chicago in the present day, current injury from this outrageous business of contract purchase of houses, so that you pay the seller gradually, but you don't get ownership until 35 years down the line instead of a mortgage, et cetera. He made it a very current thing and an important point of discussion. How did he change your thinking, or how did he change the debate in general?
what was significant about it is he's making an analysis of the kinds of harms and atrocities that carried into the 20th century and are outside of the period of enslavement, which is critical because we think that the bill of particulars that's associated with the harms and damages go beyond the period of slavery. So slavery is the crucible that produces white supremacy in the United States, but the effects of white supremacy extend into the present moment. That's the big significance of his article, is this is a case for reparations that is not anchored exclusively in the historical events of slavery, but also involves contemporary harms and injustices.
It's always useful, you know, to have a public moment. There have been a number of moments, you know, in the last 30 years that sparked excitement. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a lot of conversation for about a year after the, you know, the publication came out in the Atlantic, and then it went right back under the rug.
But I want to also add that a tremendous amount of energy for the reparations movement has come forward from a movement that's called ADOS, American Descendants of Slavery, who have emerged over the past 3 years or so in the social media context. So this is a movement that has emerged out of the social media world. It's been very important in pushing for reparations on the part of Black Americans.
Coming up, if it came to choices as to how to make Black America whole, would free post-high school education outrank, say, guaranteed health care? What about solid, fair housing? What about decarceration? This is Open Source. Speaking of reparations for slavery, Thomas Kramer at the University of Connecticut is one of numerous scholars who have tried to calculate the debt, dollar by dollar, slave by slave, hour by hour on the plantation. What is special about Thomas Kramer is that he grew up in Germany, where every school child had to face the immeasurable but real debt for the Holocaust. For slavery in the U.S., he could begin by counting the unpaid workers.
I use historical wages of free market laborers at the time, which were tiny, like 11 cents per hour, something small. And counted up all the man, woman, and child hours that were available to slave owners at the time and multiplied that with the hourly wage on the free labor market to get an estimate of what the enslaved would likely have charged at the time. And although the amounts are very small, it adds up to a tremendous amount.
And this is lost wages, in effect.
Yes. And the estimates are very conservative because the wages I used were for unskilled labor. Many of the enslaved were skilled. So the estimate is really conservative, but it's huge.
$14 trillion, you say, roughly the U.S. GDP.
Yeah, in 2009 dollars, it was $14.2 trillion. Today, it would be much more than that, of course.
You grew up in Germany well after the Third Reich and World War II. What does a German learn about reparations?
Well, that's actually where I took my inspiration for doing reparations research. I grew up at a time when the Holocaust was front and center in my entire high school curriculum in nearly every subject. We watched documentaries, talked about the Holocaust, learned about it. And of course, it made me feel very ashamed of being German. And I always wished I would have the opportunity to tell a survivor how I felt. And I never thought that would ever be possible. But then one day, this actually happened when my family befriended a family that had recently moved from Israel to Germany in my hometown of Tübingen. And during one dinner, the family father, Mietschu Langer, opened up and told us his experiences of the Holocaust when he was a teenager. Five concentration camps and a death march. It was just unbelievable. And he saw how it emotionally affected me, and I could tell him how ashamed I felt. And his response was to embrace me. And what always struck me about him is that He had no problem, A, living in Germany of all places in his retirement age and embracing young Germans like myself at the time. After he passed away in 2015, unfortunately, I learned from his widow that he had received a reparations pension from the West German government since the 1970s to 2015. So I was wondering whether that may have had anything to do with him having that much faith in the fact that Germany had actually changed. Of course, he's an exceptional human being, and I don't want to take away from that. But I think definitely the reparations pension he received definitely didn't hurt the matter.
Did he think, did his widow think that Germany had changed?
They were convinced. In our conversations, I always felt that he was very optimistic about the fact that Germany had changed irreversibly. Whether that's true, you know, whether Germany has, is a whole different question. We have problems with neo-Nazism as well. So I'm not as optimistic as Mietje was, but I think they definitely had faith. Otherwise, they would not have relocated there.
There's nothing like repair for this sort of damage, but what then is the value of reparations?
In my mind, the word reparations is kind of a misnomer because there can be no repair, there can be no life brought back retrospectively or freedom given retrospectively. What's done is done. But what can be done is that the words of apology are gaining a symbolic meaning of sincerity when they're paired with a financial symbol. So I view reparations, even if they're very large, as nothing more than a symbol, because there's nothing that, like with my friend Mietje, there's just nothing that could have made up for the fact that he lost his entire family and he suffered 5 concentration camps. He barely survived himself and a death march. This is something that you cannot represent in money. But you can apologize and pair it with a financial symbol that you actually mean what you're saying.
Those are important ideas. Change in a population, in a racist population, but also a token that does something very real.
I believe it does, because it did give my friend Mietje faith that Germany had actually changed. And I hope that he is right, that it has permanently. And it gave me the feeling that my country was taking its responsibilities seriously and at least did something, although it's much too small, but anything would be too small.
Sandy Darity and Kirsten Mullen, I want to push you some on the logics and the politics of your reparations. Are you wary, for starters, of what's called race essentialism in the demarcation of victims and villains in the stories of slavery and of the gigantic American experiment? Is it all black and white? And not only that, but provable family links required to get compensation?
Since we anchor the original basis for unmet restitution on the failure of the nation to provide the formerly enslaved with 40 acres, and we analyze the long-term consequences of that failure, which took place at the same time that significant numbers of white Americans were receiving 160-acre land allotments in the western part of the United States. It's the descendants of the folks who were never given that restitution who should be the recipients of reparations today. And so it's not a question of essentializing race or claiming something about the intrinsic nature of Black people in the United States. In fact, we're not talking about all Black Americans. We're talking specifically about those Black Americans who do have a lineage connection to the folks who were enslaved in the United States.
I can hear that you're talking about building opportunity forward, but I'm still wondering about inclusion. The alternative thought that your book prompted in my head would be to go back to a lot of those great handouts to white folks and not cheat the Black folks this time. Those homestead acts, 160-acre tracts, as you say, of free land. The New Deal without restriction on what kinds of workers get the benefits. The GI Bill in higher education we spoke about, the FHA loans to new homeowners, but this time make sure that Black people are all in.
So it seems like you're talking about, you know, prevention versus compensation. And maybe you're talking too about suspension, right, of the harms, or possibly you're talking too about, you know, what would happen if we had some universal programs that were actually executed according to the law. But if your goal is to eliminate the racial wealth gap and you have a universal program, right, the wealth gap remains.
And when we start talking about things like going back and doing the policy correctly,
right,
what we're really talking about is suspending the harm. But suspending the harm, as Malcolm X would say, is the equivalent of pulling the knife out, but it's not the equivalent of healing the wound that's right, caused by the knife being put in your back. And so we're really talking about healing the wound. And so the compensatory dimension requires something other than just reversing the bad practices. And of course, there's a need to reverse those bad practices. There's an absolute need in the context, for example, of anti-Black police violence. And that's something that would not necessarily be remedied by a reparations project. But to the extent that we are engaged in recognizing that there's a need to compensate for past and ongoing harms, then we have to talk about something that is specific for Black American descendants of U.S. slavery. There's no other group, possibly with the exception of Native Americans, who have a claim for the type of debt that is associated with the historical experience of Black American descendants of slavery.
Right. I'm glad you mentioned it, because from the standpoint of justice, can you not make reparations at the same time to the Native Americans, whose land the settlers stole? And they killed a lot of Indians, too.
So absolutely, you know, Native Americans have a claim that they could make on the U.S. government. But that is not the claim that From Here to Equality is focused on. We are focused solely in this moment on reparations for Black American descendants of U.S. slavery.
Yeah. Let me add that the claim that we're making, as Kirsten said earlier, is a claim for the material conditions for full citizenship in the United States.
Right.
To the best of our understanding, the Native American claim for reparations surrounds a demand for sovereignty. And so they are not the same types of claims, and they should not be merged or collapsed onto one another.
Don't they have to work together politically just to get votes in Congress?
I don't know.
We don't know.
I don't know the answer to that.
Okay. Japanese American reparations was on the docket. People didn't say, well, what about Black American reparations?
Good point.
Fair enough. And I don't think they necessarily should have. I mean, these are different claims, and they are claims that have their own degree of integrity.
Okay. I'm still wanting you to imagine that in the best of all outcomes, a real movement gets rolling for major overhaul of the opportunity ladders, shall we say, in this country. In a spirit of idealism and rededication, it's still going to come down to political choices and targets and what Congress says it can afford. And you never get everything on your menu, so it comes down to the strategic essentials. Would we take free higher education ahead of free medical care, for example, or first-class housing guarantees and foolproof mortgages ahead of a livable minimum wage? And where are decarceration and law enforcement without the racial profiling? What is negotiable here?
This is a Sophie's choice. You know?
Right.
Why must we choose? You know, these are, you know, problems that have existed in this country for a very long time. And, you know, Nicole Hannah-Jones and others have said, this is not a moment to settle. This is a moment to think big. And if that is, you know, our want, then yes, we should, you know, there are groups that are attached to each of these, you know, these issues that you have spelled out here. And I think it would be terrific if there was a coalition. But this notion that you have to pick one group or to pit, you know, one type of remedy against another, I think is a false one.
People have never said, well, we have to slash the defense budget to be able to spend on social programs, but they frequently say the opposite.
I'm still supposing that it will come down to choices. Choice A is we're building a forward-looking social democracy whose colorblind first principle is attend to the needy and provide for the future. That's sort of Bernie Sanders. Choice B is slavery-based reparations for real harm. Show your racial identity, locate an ancestor who lived under slavery, and then pick your remedy. The enterprises are very different in spirit.
I think that they can be pursued simultaneously.
I do want to say, too, you know, yes, slavery was a crucible from which all of these ills spring, but you also had, you know, nearly 100 years of Jim Crow, white terrorism, the destruction of, you know, vast amounts of Black property, both business and residential, and, you know, Black lives destroyed. But then you have coming into the present. I mean, the situation has not ended. And there's never been this period when all was right with Black America in terms of how the protections, the laws, inaction, silence on the part of the federal government. It's not just a question of what happened during the period of slavery. We're dealing with ongoing assaults, ongoing traumas, ongoing injuries. We have seen that the U.S. government can do tremendous things when they feel compelled to do so. And we have seen a tremendous groundswell of active engagement in the form of protests of Americans in every single state in the country, you know, saying, yes, we need to rethink this. Mm. I think, you know, the American people need to be given an opportunity to weigh in and say, you know, there's a panoply of things that we need to be working on maybe simultaneously.
Yeah, I mean, if the goal is to produce a just society, the society must address racial injustice.
Absolutely. Speaking of rethinking, two hindsight questions. One, the civil rights movement, an enormously important era that made history about justice in the Civil Rights Acts of 64, 65, but did not move the needle, really, on Black net worth.
That's true. That wasn't the goal of those acts, for one thing.
No, they weren't designed.
They weren't designed to do that.
Right. What is your hindsight on affirmative action and what it achieved? I'm thinking specifically university admissions.
Affirmative action is an anti-discrimination measure. So it's a procedure for pulling the knife out. It is not a procedure for healing the wound. Hmm. It doesn't compensate people for having been subjected to discrimination. And so as a consequence, it doesn't even approximate the intent of the reparations program that we have in mind, because it does not tackle wealth inequality. Hmm. If anything, affirmative action influences what type of employment opportunities you might have and your income level, but it doesn't have any significant effect on people's wealth position.
Finally, the word closure. Have you marked a calendar somewhere with when it happens, and does it include something like parity in Black and white wealth?
Yes. We would like to see the enactment of a reparations program. And once it is underway, we would like to see the commissioners conduct their research, hold hearings across the country, and within 18 months, produce a report that would include recommendations for how reparations will be paid and to whom. And we anticipate that, you know, within a decade, those payments would be made.
And what's your date for closure, Sandy?
10 years from the onset of the reparations program, hopefully.
That's pretty quick. And how close to parity are we at that point?
Well, that's the objective, is to be at parity with respect to wealth differentials between whites and Blacks in the United States. There would be no more average wealth differential.
William Darity and Kirsten Mullen, From Here to Equality is an exciting vision, and it's been a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks also to Thomas Kramer. Please think of supporting Open Source. The best way is by becoming a monthly subscriber on Patreon. You'll get extras like Adam Coleman's ongoing series about reading in a time of social distance. This week, he's talking to Leslie Kern about rethinking cities during the pandemic. Find it at patreon.com/radioopensource. Our show this week was produced by Conagillies, Adam Coleman, and our superb engineer, George Hicks. Mary McGrath keeps the books on our debts. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time on Open Source.
Hub
and Spoke. Audio Collective.